As a professor, I believe that Henry David Thoreau makes a compelling, if unorthodox, model teacher. I admire the way in which he uses quirky anecdotes, engaging digressions, and provocative details to stimulate imaginative and critical thought. I didn't expect, however, that his unnerving account of the ocean would evoke a sense of my own ideal in teaching. Thoreau and I came to Cape Cod from seemingly different but ultimately similar places. He traveled from the hardwood forests of the Northeast, and I arrived from the arid steppes of the West. But we share the quality of being, as he put it, inlanders. Having climbed mountains, we'd both experienced vast horizontal perspectives from high points above the Maine woods and the Wyoming prairies. For new arrivals, open vistas can be psychologically threatening. A visitor to Wyoming once told me that, "The grasslands are unsettling. I feel so small, so exposed." After 25 years on the high plains, this sense of the land stretching to the curvature of the earth feels like home to me. I become claustrophobic if I can't see the horizon. Thoreau's encounter with the ocean evoked a sense of an inlander's awe with staggering abundance. He perceived a vast, fruitful plain, writing that, "The sea was spotted with menhaden far and wide. Such is its inexhaustible fertility." Likewise, the pioneers thought the prairies held countless bison. But now we struggle to sustain these once limitless bounties. Given my experience of the high plains, the ocean should have generated a familiar feeling of expansiveness, which it did, until Thoreau and I looked into the distance and encountered, or at least imagined, a third dimension, one that is missing from the world of inlanders in Concord and Laramie. The abyssal depth gives way to deep existential angst. "We looked off and saw the water growing darker and darker and deeper the farther we looked," he wrote, "till it was awful to consider, and it appeared to have no relation to the friendly land either as shore or bottom." He asked, "Of what use is a bottom if it is out of sight, if it is 2 or 3 miles from the surface, and you are to be drowned so long before you get to it, though it were made of the same stuff with your native soil?" On hot afternoons at the dune shack where I was staying, when the breezes were just pushing around the limpid air, I walked down to the ocean and went in, mostly. That is, I was in the ocean, but I stayed on the land. I'm a competent swimmer, but I wanted no part of being physically and psychologically over my head. Of what use is a bottom if it cannot be touched? And in that moment, I realized that this was the feeling I wanted to evoke in my students. I teach at the University of Wyoming. Having begun in the entomology department and then metamorphosed into my current position, split between philosophy and creative writing. This odd journey began by wading into the surf of science, keeping my foot planted firmly in the sand of empiricism and rationality. I baited my hook with meaty methods and fished for objective facts. But then I chose to go deeper, until I was lifted on the swells of an emotional connection to the natural world and felt the undertow of spiritual understanding. At first, I treaded water, frantically trying to keep the friendly land of reductionism in sight. Today, I spend more time floating on my back in places like the dunes of Cape Cod. And yes, I regularly swim back to the shore of data and calculation, but once you've known the joyful terror of unfathomable depths, the land is never quite the same. My students like their beaches of theism or atheism, absolutism or relativism, conservatism or liberalism. Most are willing to splash in the surf, testing the waters of believing otherwise. But I want to draw them deeper and deeper until they can't feel or see the bottom. They don't need to be cast adrift, only to have their hearts race in that felt-sensed moment of bottomlessness and realize how much they don't and never will know.